Howdy, I'm Nolan Gray, your friendly neighborhood city planner and the research director at California YIMBY, where we're hard at work making California an affordable place to live, work, and raise a family. Astute observers might have noticed a rebrand for the graphics for this episode. I'm excited to share that the Abundance Podcast is going to be part of our larger Metropolitan Abundance Project. Of course, we still have a lot of hard work to do on housing policy in California, but we're really excited. We're going to be expanding our focus a little bit, at least on some of our work, and thinking about issues beyond housing and places beyond California. In the coming episodes, my colleague Ned Resnikoff and I will be doing an episode explaining what's going on there. But in the meantime, we have some amazing programming for you. In this episode, I talked to Ben Raderstorf. He's the vice president of House Sacramento, an all-volunteer grassroots pro-housing group in the California Capital Region. In his day job, he's a pro-democracy advocate, but on nights and weekends, he works to make his adopted hometown more affordable, livable, walkable, bikeable, and resilient. I like all those things. You can find him on Twitter at Braderstorf, Braderstorf. I refuse to say X. Okay, in any case, this is a fantastic episode. We're going to be talking about some of the really exciting things that have happened on the zoning reform front in Sacramento. And I think there's a lot of lessons for other cities, certainly across California and across the country. And with that, onto the show.
We'll dive right into it. Hey, Ben, how are you?
Hey, Nolan. It's great to see you.
Well, it's good to be chatting. While we were all away at YIMBY Town, some amazing things happened in Sacramento, right?
They did. They did. We were really sad it lined up because it meant some people couldn't be there for the vote. But yeah, we from our point of view, we made history in the city of Sacramento, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so talk about that. What exactly, what was this general plan update, zoning? What's kind of the general context for the reforms?
Yeah, so this is our long scheduled general plan update, like most cities do. So for those who aren't deep in the weeds, you know, chances are, I think almost certainly your city has a general plan, which is its big governing document that, you know, everything sort of flows down from, and how the city is set up and how it's regulated. And every certain number of years, the city goes through and it updates that plan. And it really is a big opportunity to sort of rewrite big ideas from scratch. So the past really 3-4 years in Sacramento have been leading up to this, you know, the sense that the 2023 general plan update, which is supposed to last the city until 2040, is the sort of window that they're looking for, was the opportunity if we want to do something really big on land use, on housing, that this was it. You know, this was the window. We're not going to get this again for almost another generation. So what they did, and it's a long, complicated document that has about 5 different strategies, all of which are really important, and I'd love to get into. But the commitment really from day one was, we're going to find a way to end exclusionary zoning in Sacramento, not chip away at it, not sort of work incrementally towards more housing, but to fully undo the legacy of exclusionary choices, and this idea that we're going to use zoning to keep certain people out of certain neighborhoods. The city wanted to go all the way, and you know, what did we need to do to remove that policy? And in a lot of ways, that's what we did.
Yeah, it sounds similar in a lot of respects to the Minneapolis update, right? Because my understanding is they got rid of single family zoning through this general plan or comp plan avenue, right?
Yeah, and it's pretty similar to what Minneapolis and some other cities have done. The idea, you know, that in some ways I think Sacramento goes a little further, and we're, you know, we can sort of talk through, but the core of what the plan involved, it's a full switch from sort of unit based density based zoning. And we're going to get really into the weeds here. So, you know your listeners better than I do. If there's anything you want me to sort of pause and explain more, just let me know. But we shifted from this idea of sort of density-based zoning, the idea that the zoning code says, you know, per parcel of land, per lot, you can have this many homes, right? And in most cities and most neighborhoods across the country, that's overwhelmingly one, right? Single-family zoning, that's what we mean when we say single-family zoning. But Sacramento, we wanted to go a little further and get rid of that idea that that's how we should be regulating our city, right? That we should be regulating by number of people who are allowed to live in a certain place, and shift over purely to regulating the buildings, right? Like, I think of it as regulating the city itself, not the people who get to live in it. So this is, you know, you probably heard of this, you know, your listeners probably heard of this idea of a floor area ratio or form-based code. So we switched fully to a form-based floor area ratio code. So what that means now in any part of Sacramento, any residential area in the city, Nowhere in the zoning code going forward is it going to say you can only have X number of units of housing per lot. It still, obviously, it still has other, you know, sort of restrictions or limitations. Height limits still apply, setbacks still apply. But the idea is that, you know, we're no longer regulating the number of households you can have in the building that you can put in that piece of land. Does that make sense?
Yeah, right. And so the idea is you're for those who might not have heard of form-based code, you're regulating what the building looks like, but you're not regulating necessarily how many units are within that building. Is that right?
Exactly. And, you know, I think of this as like, it's one of the few sort of like intuitively, like as soon as you sort of make the switch, it's pretty self-evident, right? And something I've been really surprised by this switch to the form-based code is it actually, you know, it's pretty appealing across the scale. So, you know, if you're a YIMBY or if you're a builder, you're trying to make more housing happen. You know, obviously, this is the holy grail, right? Like not be arbitrarily limited in how many units of housing you can build.
I like that word, arbitrary. You know,
right.
That's my word.
Yeah, yes, you do. But it also is like it's a concept that makes a lot more sense even to people who are sort of inherently skeptical of some of this stuff. And it's getting out of this idea that, you know, we're sort of you know, we're gonna come in and we're gonna bulldoze your neighborhood and we're gonna change it dramatically. You know, a lot of times when we talk about pro housing reforms, that's not what we mean at all, right? All we mean is that, like, okay, if you can have an equivalent size single family home, right? Like you should be able to also slice that up into studio apartments, right? Like even if people have strong feelings about how their neighborhood looks and feels, which you know, I know is true, it, you know, there's no reason that we should be biasing, privileging single family homes at the expense of smaller, more affordable types of housing. So yeah, in a weird way, there's a lot through this process, but there was sort of a moment when I was like, okay, we're going to introduce some unit caps back into this. And actually, some of the people it gave heartburn to was neighborhood associations and sort of other people that we often think of as not being excited about new housing. But for them, it said, like, wait a second, we're gonna declare that my lot has to have a fourplex on it. And it's like, no, that's not what we're doing at all, right? Like the amount of housing that your lot can build is governed by the size of your lot. And that's a much more, I don't know, in a way, it's a much more approachable concept. And you know, it again, because it's not arbitrary, right? You know, now every lot, the amount you can build on it is determined by the square footage of the lot, not sort of, you know, some planner with a map said, okay, this is a two.
Yeah, well, and so on this point, was there any adjustment to the actual massing of the building made? I know that was one of the challenges with Minneapolis was they said, we're getting rid of single family zoning, but we're not increasing the actual envelope. And so it was kind of hard to get additional units in these buildings.
Yeah, so a bunch of different things that they're doing. Some of them are really, you know, the boring but critical stuff like setbacks and lot coverage ratios, all of which they're changing to make it easier to build small multifamily in these neighborhoods. But the other big thing that we really pushed for and we got is that we're basically doubling the allowable building within half mile of transit, right? So if you live within a 10, 15 minute walk of a light rail station here, for our, you know, as part of our climate goals, as part of our commitment to be a more sustainable city, we want to make sure that those are the areas where we're able to build the most housing. So those are areas, you know, the floor area ratio now there is 2.0, which is really quite a lot.
A lot. I mean, your typical R1 is going to be like 0.5, if that.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, and that's something we're seeing across the city. But I think the sense is, you know, in most places in the city, you can at the very least see sort of four or five plexes. And in our really priority areas, we may see up to 8, 9, 10 units.
That's exciting. Yeah. I mean, so the missing middle piece, it's been exciting because I think, you know, we're in the stage now where, okay, we are all excited about like the first few cities to eliminate single family zoning. And it's slow to figure out exactly how to design this. But I feel like in Spokane and Sacramento, we're finally starting to see complete reform packages that are actually potentially going to yield some missing middle units.
Totally. And what I really like about it, and the, you know, the sort of idea of switching to a form-based code is that it's a permanent reform, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, you're not moving it up so that the next time you have a housing crisis, you got to move it up again. Right, it's setting up this much more dynamic sort of regulatory framework where, you know, if the pressure increases, well, then the dynamic response is you're going to see more smaller units built, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of free flowing thing. So all the city has to do you know, is there's only one number that they have to adjust, which is sort of that floor area ratio versus this, like, okay, now we got to consider if like the areas where we had duplexes, now do we want them to have fourplexes and that kind of thing? Like it's getting out of that sort of zero sum headspace entirely.
Yeah, I love that. Or just the whole, I feel like the poverty of use zoning, right? Of trying to come up with like how many units are appropriate on any given lot? And it's like, well, we kind of have to discover this, right? We don't really necessarily know, and it changes over time.
And it really depends on the lot, right? Like, you know, it's this idea that we're going to sort of create one size fits all sort of patterns when, you know, you walk around any neighborhood in any city, you're going to see big 10,000 square foot lots and then some, you know, little ones in the corners and places. And, you know, getting out of that idea that we're sort of, you know, we're sort of going one by one and going, okay, how many homes can be on this lot? And rather saying like, oh, let's just make a formula that's fair, that's impartial, you know, big lot, more housing, small lot, less housing. I mean, it's not that hard.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent it helped Sacramento. The city already has such an amazing fabric of missing middle. I mean, when you're around Midtown, for example, I mean, it's like, we're talking about legalizing a sixplex, and it's not like a hypothetical, like imagine Hong Kong. It's like, you know, that building over there on that street.
looking out my window and in Midtown Sacramento, and there's a, I think it's a 12-plex across the street from me. And, you know, I'm sitting in a single family home. So,
yeah, that's fantastic.
I think that's a key part of it. But, you know, I think that also, you know, something that, you know, I'm sure you feel this and notice this, is that like often missing middle housing in every city is this sort of invisible presence there in the background, right? You know, you walk around LA, you walk around San Francisco, you walk around Berkeley, California, you walk around East Coast cities, missing middle is everywhere. It's just all old, right? It's all buildings that were built in these neighborhoods in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, before we started making them illegal. And that's something we really tried to capture here in Sacramento, that it, you know, this is not about doing something that's never been done before. It's just re-legalizing, you know, the sort of housing that used to make our cities affordable.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to frame it. I'm wondering too, are there folks building missing middle typologies in Sacramento? I know this is another challenge of like, we haven't been building this typology at scale in so many US cities that we don't really have developers or bankers who understand what this product is and how to build it and finance it. What was your team's experience with that?
It's totally a challenge. It is something that we are seeing more and more of. You know, even in my neighborhood, I have, you know, five or six projects within five or six blocks that I can think of that are going up now or have gone up in the last year or two. So we're definitely seeing it start to happen. I'm really hopeful that especially with these latest updates, we're just going to see a wave of new builders. And you know, as you say, right, like we got to get out of this sort of economic model where the only housing we build is either, you know, big 5-over-1 apartment buildings or, you know, sprawling greenfield, you know, 300 single family home subdivisions. And that is going to take time, right? Like it's going to take time that people got to learn how to make money doing it. And, you know, we got to see a growing competitive market to build these things. We're starting to see it in Sacramento. We're hoping we're going to see a lot more.
We've been talking about the missing middle piece a lot, but I mean, I think cities need a range of different types of development, right? And you are just going to need apartment buildings. I'm wondering, how does the general plan update affect your typical mid-rise multifamily?
So in a lot of ways, actually, that's something that isn't so much in this general plan update, but only because it's something that Sacramento has already done a ton on. And the biggest thing, a change that was made, you know, four or five years ago, is we switched to something that's called ministerial approvals, which again, you know, really, really in the weeds language alert.
We have to go there. It's the most important piece of California planning. Yeah,
totally. in a way, you know, I almost think that this is potentially an even bigger deal than the ending single family zoning. And what this basically means is, you know, we switched from a political to a depoliticized approval process. So how it used to work here and how it works in most cities, certainly in California, and I kind of think everywhere, is that project by project approvals go in various ways through elected officials, right? So whether that's, you know, a sort of appointed planning commission or through your city council, right? You have some sort of step where somebody's making, again, a kind of arbitrary decision about whether or not this building is appropriate or not. That's how it used to work. And you know, interestingly, in Sacramento, you know, there's always been a little more of a pro-housing culture. So it wasn't that even that projects were necessarily getting stopped. You know, there wasn't a lot of sort of NIMBY organizing or any other thing about that. But it just adds this, you know, delay and uncertainty and sort of ambiguity into the process that really discourages people from wanting to invest in big housing projects, right? If, you know, if there's always a chance that somebody's going to make a stink and then the city council is going to decide to kill it for sort of arbitrary reasons. So what the city did is they shifted it. So now anything under, I think it's 200 units, doesn't go through planning commission or city council at all, right? It's a staff.
That's huge.
You know, again, what's called a ministerial process. And the way I think about it is, you know, this is the same way we do any other sort of permitting or approval process in our local government, right? You know, you want to put a sink in your basement, right? Like, you don't have to go to the planning commission to like get their beg their permission to you know, remodel your basement or something like that. And so we just started thinking about housing the same way we think about, you know, permitting a new local business, right? And we have zoning codes, we have building codes. These are objective standards. We can have staff, you know, compare your application to the objective standard and say, okay, yeah, you meet all the criteria, you're automatically approved, or you don't, you're automatically denied. But like either way, it's not a political one. And what that ends up doing is it really de-escalates the sort of local politics around housing and makes it much more sort of fair, arbitrary, or not arbitrary, fair, objective, and efficient. And, you know, when it's predictable like that, we saw a huge wave of new multifamily getting built. And at, you know, at this point, we've built enough sort of big new multifamily projects that, you know, now our biggest concern is that rents are dropping so fast that nobody's going to want to build housing anymore, which is the best possible problem to have.
Yeah, no, that was kind of the funny element of Yimby Town, the discourse. You know, it's like Austin kind of did just go on a building tear, and now the rents are falling in real terms. Not even like slowed down rent growth is good, but like falling in real terms. And they're, you know, we're having this conversation. It's like, well, you know, there are other reasons why we have to address these zoning issues. You know, for example, in Austin, they're building a lot of housing, but they're building loads of parking, right? And it's like a lot of that's a function of historically, it was a function of requirements or where the housing is being built. But to this point about ministerial versus discretionary, I mean, it's so key too, because here in Los Angeles, every project over 50 units has to go through a discretionary review process. And so essentially almost all of your large apartment buildings have to go through this. And, you know, something that's been really beneficial in recent years is the local TOC program saying, well, we're going to give you a whole bunch of additional extra housing. And if you blow past that 50 unit threshold, we're not going to make your project discretionary. We're still going to have it be ministerial. And I mean, when we looked at the data, this was, you know, for TOC projects that were ministerial versus vanilla, you know, entitled projects, you're cutting down the entitlement timeline by a year, right? And that's potentially tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars in permitting hurdles and holding costs that are being taken off of these projects and making a lot more projects pencil. So it's wonky, but it's so key.
So important. And it, you know, the other thing about it that I think is so key is like these sort of, you know, the sort of accidental barriers to housing, you know, whether it's uncertainty or whether it's delays, those sort of things, like those are the things that are especially bad in times when the market's not good for building housing anyway. So there's a real compounding effect, right? So somewhere like right now, when interest rates are high, right? Like that makes it so much worse to have big delays in your project, because, you know, you're potentially paying interest, or, you know, you're sort of facing these compounding effects, right? So when, you know, when the market's good, when it's easy to build new housing, like maybe it's not that big of a deal to make somebody wait an extra year. But when you're already facing headwinds, then it can just absolutely blow up in your face.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think it falls hardest too on smaller projects as well, right? I mean, if you're a small developer, you know, you're a big multifamily national developer or a new subdivision developer, you've got attorneys on staff, you've got planners and a retainer, right? You're fine. But your small, you know, I always say some guy and his cousin's fourplex builder, they don't have that. And, or these might, in the California context, these might be builders who don't even speak English as a first language, or they don't have the sophistication with the permitting process that larger builders might have. And if you say to them, well, we're going to have you go through this long discretionary process where you're going to have to do CEQA and you're going to have to sort of have multiple public hearings, and there's going to be back and forth negotiation,
Those
You're going to
projects
have
just
to
might
be
not
really
happen.
connected. You know, you're going to have to like know your city council people. You're going to have to have lobbyists. Like all of those things are ones that like big, empowered, wealthy, largely white developers are going to be able to get around. But
Right.
like you know, but like a first generation, you know, builder crew that's, you know, wants to do, you know, their sort of first 8-unit project, they're screwed.
Right. Well, and especially in a place like Sacramento, I mean, so many of our best neighborhoods were built by small local builders like that, right? Who we've totally wiped them out in California with all these processes. And I mean, I think we're on the same page on this, but this stuff is necessary but not sufficient, right? I mean, we have to rebuild our construction labor. We have to deal with construction costs. We have to address things like building codes. But the beauty of what Sacramento's done is they've said, well, at least we're not going to have one additional barrier to these types, especially these types of infill projects that are already pretty tough to build.
And you know, it's I think about it in a lot of different ways. We've spent decades tilting the scales in the wrong direction, right? You know, tilting the scale towards greenfield sprawl, tilting the scale towards big single family homes, tilting the scale towards, you know, big sort of, you know, quasi corporate developers against the scale of small infill local, you know, diverse, right? Like the sort of housing that makes our cities, you know, really wonderful and lovely to build in. We've been discouraging that for, you know, half a century now, and we're really starting to see those consequences.
Right. I want to talk about a couple other things that Sacramento, I think, did to clear the runway here. As I understand, Sacramento was one of the earlier California cities to completely eliminate parking requirements, right? That was,
It's been a sort of incremental process, and obviously, as you and listeners probably know, a lot of this has been done at the statewide level. In California, parking minimums are now, you know, essentially banned near transit in California, which does cover a lot of really high priority areas. But the general plan now fully gets rid of parking minimums citywide, which is a big deal. And you know, I think about it. It's, you know, parking minimums to me are, they're sort of a double whammy, right? Because on one hand, they're terrible for new housing. I think they add, you know, like 12% on average to housing construction costs, right? So think, you know, you want to buy a new house, calculate out what a, you know, sort of 12% addition on your housing price is going to be, right? Like that's what parking minimums do. But it's also, you know, it's a climate death spiral, right? It's like when we are mandating parking, we are mandating the oversupply of parking, we're mandating that people live car-centric lives, right? You know, we're forcing everybody to have a car, right? Because they're already paying for it. And then, you know, once we build our cities around this idea of we got to have enough parking, right? It becomes very hard to not have a car. It becomes very hard not to drive. And it sort of traps us in this death spiral mindset. And if we just get rid of them, right? If we just say, okay, if you want to live in a home without parking, you're allowed to do that now. And we see, you know, I live a block and a half away from, I think it's a 180 unit project, with no parking, no parking. And you know, the vast majority, I talked to somebody who lives there, the vast majority of people who live in that, you know, it's brand new market rate, really beautiful apartments. Most people there, you know, they work in downtown Sacramento. They're, you know, state government workers you know, they work in the legislature, that kind of thing, and almost all of them walk to work. They can do that because they're, you know, again, they're not already paying for parking.
Right. Well, and I'm gonna keep I'm a big Sacramento fanboy, so I'm going to keep hyping up Sacramento. Because, growing up, I actually had an aunt and uncle in Sacramento, so we visit somewhat regularly. It's very, very sleepy, kind of average town. They were both state civil servants. But, going back now there for work, I'm like, the city has an amazing street grid. If you work for the state government, you can easily walk on this beautiful little street grid with an amazing tree canopy and this beautiful historical stock of missing middle mixture, mixed diverse neighborhoods with new mid-rise multifamily buildings going in. And it feels very much like the YIMBY promised land in some respects, from a California perspective.
Yeah, I think of it, you know, when you see those sort of renderings, those idealized renderings of missing metal, you know, sort of drawing sketches, like it always feels to me, it's like, oh, that looks like home. But it is, it's, you know, and I think though the lesson there that I think is really important for anybody listening to this to understand is like Sacramento was originally built as a sprawling single family grid. Right. You know, I live in a single family Victorian house. It was built in 1880. And in a time when that was the only thing that was getting built in Sacramento, right? You know, originally that was the plan. And a lot of our streetcar suburbs, you know, were totally built. They were built by, you know, developers building sort of big single family neighborhoods. And what, you know, the key that happened is that it took them, you know, Sacramento never had the same sort of reaction that a lot of cities in California had, where there was a trying to, you know, freeze development in amber. Some of that is because, as you say, it was sort of a sleepy, small government town, right? But it never had that sort of like, oh my God, we gotta protect what we have. So there, you know, the missing middle types were built all the way up into the 70s and 80s here. And that's the reason why it feels so good. And the lesson there is like anybody's town can feel this way, right? It's like Sacramento rules, but like any city is just a decade or two out from feeling the same way. And that's something that, you know, we so miss from, you know, you walk around like the East Bay or, you know, San Jose or other places where it just feels like you couldn't have that. And it's like, that's not true. You just got to legalize it.
Yeah. You made a point there that I really love, which is that part of what works about Sacramento is it's 100, it's almost, you know, it's over 100 years of allowing like neighborhood change and densification and experimentation. And so that's something I always notice when I'm walking around Sacramento is like, you have like different little missing middle experiments from like every decade of the American 20th century urban development experience. And, you know, from a perspective of like intense visual order or uniformity, right, doesn't have a lot for you. But from a perspective of like lots of little experiments and concepts and dreams embodied in all of these little buildings. Or, I mean, another thing I love with Sacramento is all the little, what we would call them now, we call them accessory commercial units, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you walk down many of Sacramento's great like shopping streets, and it's a bunch of old Victorian homes, not unlike what I think you live in, with a commercial space that was built out at some point, right? And it was not this sort of like big master plan shopping district, but it ends up producing these granular experiences that are just so much more interesting than I think the typical American neighborhood.
Totally. And it's, you know, what's really funny about this, I always feel so silly making this comparison because obviously Sacramento is still a kind of sleepy cow town in some ways. But when you walk around downtown Sacramento, like the closest thing to me in terms of, you know, where else you sort of see this sort of experience in that, you know, you're walking, it's not like there's a main commercial street. It's not like there's, you know, like here's where the businesses are, here's where the people live. It's all mixed together, you know, restaurants and little offices and multifamily apartments and single family homes, you know, that's what makes somewhere like New York feel really magical, right? Like I love to walk around New York because you never know what you're going to find, right?
Right.
And Sacramento has the same thing. And that's the sort of organic, you know, freeform growth that we've made illegal in the vast majority of American cities.
So what I'm always saying, if you like Tokyo, you're going to love Sacramento.
With a big tomato.
No, it's fantastic. And then of course, when you combine that, you know, you say cowtown, but it's like, well, the city has an amazing, you know, farm to table culture. And so there's a lot, you know, I think another interesting thing to do about Sacramento is if you actually compare California's major cities on permitting rates, Sacramento just swamps, right? Like San Jose and SF and LA and San Diego on a per capita basis. What's going on there? Why?
Yeah. I mean, so some of it is some of the reforms and changes that have happened. You know, when you make it easy to build more housing gets built. It's not rocket science. It's not as much as people want to say, you know, that there's big complicated equations to it all. It really just comes down to, is it easier or harder to build housing? But I do think there are some other sort of key things that that have made it easier. One, you know, we have a really remarkable sort of city government and planning staff. It's definitely a byproduct to be in a state government town. You get a wonky electorate, you get a wonky city hall. We have some remarkable planners and permitting folks and others who really get it. You know, they see their job as to, you know, as to say yes, not to say no. Which is something that I hope we are seeing a trend where more and more of their equivalents across the country are feeling that same permission to like actually see their job as you know, helping their city grow and breathe and not, you know, keep it locked in amber. So that's one thing. The other part of it that like I think is really key is, you know, there's sort of, you know, the backstory of this is like, there's not really a sort of NIMBY undercurrent, anything in Sacramento. There's never really been a lot of organized opposition to new housing or new development. I think part of that is just like you say, you walk around Sacramento, it's funky, it's weird. The charm is that everything's really different, right? We got a lot of really old homes, and we got a lot of, sort of 1970s apartment buildings and all sorts of things. Like, it's the mixture that people really like about it. But there's also just a sense that, like, Sacramento's, it's a low ego kind of town, and it makes people feel more sort of welcoming, right? This idea that, like, oh, it might change. Oh, that'd be fun. We'll see what that is like. And I think that's the sort of attitude that, if you think about it, actually a lot of the sort of, coolest, most vibrant cities, both in the US and elsewhere, they tend to have that same openness to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned two things here. I have two kind of working pet theories, and I don't really know how you'd verify them. One, it strikes me that, yeah, capitals, state and federal, just seem to do a little bit better. I mean, because DC has like a very pro-growth culture, very high quality planning civil service. And you get that in all the metro suburbs of DC and Virginia. So that's maybe one, like, is it, you just have a public spirited sort of culture and a good civil service. My other theory with Sacramento, and this applies to why I think some interesting stuff is happening with San Diego, is there's a healthy second city mentality potentially of, like, in LA, you get this feeling of, like, well, no matter what we do, we're going to be LA. So we can just not build any housing. It's not the end of the world. Right. And I wonder if maybe cities with more of a second city perspective, and I say that with great affection.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Don't take that for granted.
We are proudly a second tier mid-sized city. I think that's right. And I think some of the specific things that have really factored in this case is, one, the housing crisis happened much quicker in Sacramento mm-hmm. than it did in somewhere like San Francisco. San Francisco has been a frog in boiling water for, 15, 20 years now, where, mm-hmm. Rents just keep creeping upwards and supply gets tighter and tighter and tighter. There never were sort of big shock moments, and, people got used to this idea that rents always go up, and that's just an iron law of California. Sacramento saw, a sort of huge boom, both immediately before the pandemic, when it sort of, when frankly, the Bay Area choking itself really started to spill over. But then also, especially in the pandemic, in an area of remote work, a lot of people really wanted to, to move to a livable mid-sized city, and Sacramento saw a ton of that. So everything happened really fast. So it felt much more, we went from not having a big homelessness problem to, 10,000 unhoused people on our streets in like 5 years. And so people are much more willing to, like, look at the problem in that situation.
This is all exciting. A lot of good ideas, right? A lot of YIMBY groups have good ideas. How did Housing Sacramento, House Sac?
Right. House Sac, yeah.
House Sac, I always call it. Okay, it is just House Sac, right. How'd you pull it off? What's the story?
That's a great question. I mean, first of all, it has been a years and years and years long effort, one that began even before I moved to Sacramento. You could write a book on like any sort of slow creeping change that then happens all at once. It's really hard to capture the sort of lessons all in one. The sort of story when things really, I think, when the momentum really shifted, sort of a lot of things, I think, came to a head really in 2020. And there was this feeling, where sort of all of the political winds really lined up. So one, for a lot of city council members, actually, interestingly, the issue got a lot of purchase very quickly as a racial equity issue. Sacramento has a very deep and intense history of redlining, like most cities in California. When you look at our old zoning maps and redlining maps next to each other, it's, you're looking at the same map, which is pretty awful and horrifying. So there really was, a feeling in 2020 that this was something the city wanted to take more seriously. It was also the same year we had really terrible wildfires in Northern California. I think for a lot of people, that made the climate crisis feel much more real and not just theoretical. We were all sitting, choking air for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time.
So that
I
was
think,
literally when I moved to LA
yeah,
in September of 2020.
exactly.
Yeah. That was that was the they call it an SF, they call it the Red Day or the Orange Day
It
or
was
something like
awful.
that.
It was awful. It was, I
Yeah.
mean, it was so apocalyptic for a reason, right? Because these things are really scary, and it is the future that we all increasingly are going to live in. And so, those two together, I think, sort of galvanized a willingness to think bigger. Obviously, those are circumstances that are outside of anyone's control. But in terms of what House Sacramento and really the much broader ecosystem did, one, we really took a non-zero sum approach to talking about this. This is something that's, it's always kind of been true in the housing coalition in Sacramento, but I think it was especially true in the last few years. It's just finding ways to think and talk about this stuff that is, it's not combative. It's not, who's wrong, who's right. It's definitely not pitting, market rate and subsidized affordable housing against each other. But really, trying to build a more sort of truly inclusive vision for the future, right? And leaning into that idea of inclusion as not just what we are trying to build in a policy sense, but also how we're gonna do politics around it. So that was one, if you pay attention to the House Sacramento Twitter account or that sort of thing, we've really made an effort to bring to it that sense of optimism that, I think is really true about the YIMBY movement, that it's fundamentally very optimistic, that it is built on the idea that things can be good for everyone. And we really tried to channel that. We did a lot of the things that, YIMBY groups do, a lot of doing the hard work of showing up at planning commission and city council and workshops and, just being the people in the room and saying the same thing over and over again and not getting too triggered when people say dumb stuff. And just calmly,
Oh, they
patient.
never say dumb stuff at planning hearings,
Never,
Ben. What are
never.
you talking
Nobody has
about?
bad takes on housing. But we so that was sort of the first stage, but I think where things really shifted is we really started to build strong relationships with both elected officials and with city staff. And we made a deliberate choice that we were going to see city government, both political and career, as our allies, as people that we want to, we need to be thinking about this from the same point of view as us. And I think that's something that, I know I've had that same instinct in the past to sort of see, planners as always the obstacle or as, the sort of people we're fighting against. But the honest truth is it's not true. That unless we want to do everything through big sweeping sort of statewide legislative reforms, like we got to have allies and we got to have people in planning departments and in city councils and planning commissions who, not only are willing to go along with this stuff, but fundamentally get why it's the right decision. To
Well, and I
really.
love that you, I mean, I love that you, because I think you're exactly right. A lot of YIMBYs maybe have an antagonistic relationship with planners, or they go to the planning hearing and they see the planner as the person who represents the status quo set of rules. We had
Exactly.
a great pro housing planning panel at YIMBY Town, and Dov Caden was actually on it. He's a planning commissioner in Sacramento and a House Sac member and a regional planner in the area. And just trying to make this case to, YIMBYs, like, hey, there are almost certainly people in your local planning department who like what you're doing and want to help you. And a productive relationship can advance policy reform so much more rapidly than an antagonistic relationship or a negative one.
And the other thing I think that's so true is like even to the degree where you feel like there are obstacles in City Hall, often those are people who know that you are right, but feel like they're not politically able to go as far as you want them to. So the other thing that
That's a really good point.
we really
Yeah.
tried to work on was proving both to City Council and to staff and to Planning Commission that a lot of the sort of boogeymen, the political boogeymen that a lot of us sort of assume are out there, that housing is an overwhelmingly unpopular issue and that, if the NIMBYs just organize, they're going to vote you all out of office. That's an assumption that almost every local elected official in America has, right? That if this is a third rail, and that if they touch single family zoning or whatever it is, that they're going to get blowback and it's going to cost them their jobs, and that impression is enormously constraining. And so what we really work to do is we A, you know, try to really show that there was a strong political constituency in the other direction, right? And really bringing people out to show up, to, you know, both be there in support when people do good things, but you know, even, you know, sort of commit to vote, make voting decisions based on this issue and that sort of thing. But then also, you know, the sort of something that's really happened here, and I suspect is sort of how it has to happen everywhere, is you're building trust, right? So you are showing that, okay, if you take one step, world's not going to end, right? You know, sky's not going to fall. You're not going to get voted out of office. And actually, people are going to be pretty happy about it, right? You know, you go to your local Reddit and people are going to be like, hey, yay, more housing. That seems great. And then the next step, and then the next step. And you know, I think, like, if there's anything that the Sacramento example shows, you know, 80 something percent of Sacramento, as much as the party Sacramento that you and I love is a, you know, very mixed use, mixed density, the old part of the city, still the vast majority of the city is single family homes, right? And so, you know, the fact that the boogeyman does not exist here, it also probably doesn't exist, at least to the same degree, in your city too. And finding ways to build that trust with your local electeds that, you know, that they can do the right thing on this issue and it's not going to cost them their jobs.
That's, yeah, I think that's so key. I mean, at the state level, I think that's partly what's happened with things like ADUs, right? Where it's like 2017, ADUs are first legalized. It's like, oh, the people are going to be out with pitchforks and torches. And then ADUs start getting built and everyone's like, oh, I love this. Can you make it even easier for me to build an ADU? And
you know, my favorite example there is, you know, Scott Wiener. Right. Scott Wiener represents what is arguably the most NIMBY constituency by any objective measure in the United States. Right. Like, there is certainly no Senate district in California that should be more hostile to Scott Wiener's politics and to the agenda that he has pushed here in Sacramento. And last night, he just got reelected with 70% of the vote. Right. So it turns out that actually even his constituents, this is what they want. They, you know, if they're not actually seeing progress, right? You know, if people are just talk, no action, then yeah, people are gonna be pissed and it's not gonna play out for you. But if you're willing to actually do the work to, you know, deliver more housing for your voters, they're gonna reward you for it.
Well, that's so true. Right, yeah. I mean, you poll people and you ask people, this is the number one quality of life issue, certainly in California and increasingly across the US, right? And you know, voters are looking for solutions. And I actually think most your typical voters mature enough to realize, yeah, we're going to have to change some of these things that might slightly change my neighborhood if we're going to tackle this issue. And I think they're more comfortable with that than maybe the typical person who's showing up at a public hearing at Tuesday at 10 a.m. and having a meltdown, right? And part of what I think YIMBY advocates like House Sack are doing is they're helping local electeds realize, oh, like, this person is not broadly representative of my community. And there are other people who feel very differently, who seem to be a little bit more reasonable, a little bit nicer. Who do you think, whose side do you think they're going to take? Right. And that's where I think your point about positivity is so key. Just showing up and saying, hey, no, a better city's possible. This is not this horrible thing that we have to endure. You know, sometimes we talk about housing like pollution, right? We do like cap and trade, or it's this horrible burden. We're so sorry. We have to build more housing. And I think something you all have especially done very effectively is saying, actually, it would be great for Sacramento if we had more of a mixture of housing typologies.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, that's one. And the other one that we, you know, have really tried to do is, you know, speak the language of your audience. And in most cases, in most cities, your audience is, you know, professional public policy people who work in City Hall. So, you know, if you go around Sacramento, you'll see our yard signs. Our yard signs say end exclusionary. We support an end to exclusionary zoning in Sacramento, which is not, you know, if we were trying to win elections, if we were trying to pass ballot issues, it'd be terrible messaging, right? It's so wonky, it's so dry. But for the people we're trying to speak to, right, like that's what's motivating, right? And knowing that we are showing up and actually care about the details of the policy, we understand that there are hard, difficult, even just logistical or administrative or bureaucratic challenges to some of these things, and leaning into those and not being angry or dismissive over them, I think has gotten us a lot of it's gotten us a lot of traction.
Well, it's this basic insight of speak in terms of people's values, right? I mean, when we were doing some of this work in Montana, right, you're talking about property rights, and right. That's a value that's salient with the audience, and it's not
illegitimate at all. This absolutely can be viewed in that lens, and it's perfectly legitimate, or from an equity lens. So, you know, I think it's great. I love those little signs too. You still see them. I don't know. I hope they stay up for many months.
Still have a lot more if anybody wants one out there. Yeah.
I might get one next time I'm in Sacramento and bring it down. Okay. A lot of progress has been made. Ministerial approvals, parking requirements gone, missing middle citywide. What's next for housing in Sacramento?
Yeah. So, I mean, the short term is, you know, we've passed the policy. Now we got to get the details right. So everything from here, you know, like any city, we've passed the general plan. Now they, you know, have to go through with a fine tooth comb everywhere in the zoning code and update everything. It's going to take some time, right? We're probably not going to see, you know, sort of the wave of new projects that we hope to see until probably end of this year, early next is when we expect the city to start issuing permits for those. So that's the first priority. But then after that, you know, I think it becomes sort of the next level, right? Like we've removed a lot of the obstacles to housing, which is one component of building a thriving, vibrant, livable city. There's a lot more that we need, right? So one of the biggest issues, like most issues in California, is how do we find more money for subsidized housing, right? We have 10,000 people who sleep on the street every night in Sacramento. And, you know, I know, as you know, and most of your listeners probably know, once somebody becomes homeless, it is so much more expensive to get them back into housing. And it's a real policy failure, and we got to pay for that mistake, right? Like, we let that happen. We got to get people back into stable, supportive situations. So we need to find more revenue for that. My view is, honestly, it's got to be a tax increase in some way, right? You know, my wife and I own our home, right? Like we gotta pitch in, right? Like we gotta do our share to undo the damage of the housing crisis. It's not enough just to, you know, get rid of the policies that caused the housing crisis. Now we gotta clean up the human cost. So I think that's step one. But then from there, it's a lot of really exciting things, right? It's how do we do more investment in transit and bike infrastructure and walkability? How do we invest in more sort of green spaces and shared third spaces? And all of those are sort of the next tier agenda, many of which are also part of the general plan that I think is really going to be the focus for the city in the next 10 years. How do we take this momentum and really make, you know, Sacramento the, you know, sort of livable paradigm that I think it can be?
Yeah. Well, so we're recording this the day after election day. So I'm coming from here in Los Angeles, and it's not final, but HLA, our initiative to essentially require the city to actually implement its own plan, I'm feeling pretty good. So I'm optimistic for the possibilities up there. We'll record something separate on that, but I think the tide is turning in the same way it's turning on these housing issues. It's also turning on transportation planning and traffic violence and in voters in LA. I mean, LA is, you know, the city that's infamous for being built around the car. And even here,
most car-centric city in America. And 75%, right. I don't know if it's come down since I last checked, but overwhelming majority of Angelenos support more bike infrastructure, more transit infrastructure. It's so cool. We do the same here. Every city can and should be doing the same.
It's exciting. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about your background. So how did you get into EMB?
Yeah, so I, you know, how Sacramento, we're an all-volunteer group. So I have a day job. I work for a voting rights nonprofit. In a lot of ways, I almost, you know, I see housing as a democracy issue. You know, I think that it is the unseen ingredient to every aspect in our economy and our society. Everyone consumes housing in one way or the other. We're all touched by the housing market. And I do, you know, deep down, I think a lot of the sort of discontent that we are feeling democratically in the United States right now, I do think that the creeping housing crisis is part of that. You know, we all feel like things are getting worse because they are, because housing has been getting more and more expensive. And we, more and more of us can't afford to live where we want to live. So that's a big part of it for me. I also, you know, the other part, so I grew up in Boulder, Colorado. And I've lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Washington, DC, Berkeley, California, and then here in Sacramento. And, you know, all of those until Sacramento were places where I, you know, had to face the reality that, you know, if I if I want to work in public interest, if I want to work for nonprofits, probably wouldn't be able to buy a home. Certainly not in a place like Boulder or Berkeley. And you know, I hate that. I hate living in a society where it feels like if you want to have a stable housing situation, you know, if you want to not be subject to the whims of rents, then you have to potentially, you know, make career choices that are not what you necessarily would love or want to do.
I've noticed that Boulder exports a lot of YIMBYs. I know I have at least three friends of mine were like born and raised in Boulder. And I think on some level, they're like, I know I can't afford to move back. And they're just seething with like productive rage over this.
It
and
is. Like, I mean, yeah. You know, Boulder, Colorado is one of the most, it is one of the most beautiful, magical places on the planet. And I have never lived somewhere that is so openly exclusionary. And the way people talk about new housing, new development is, you know, it's almost offensive. And some of it, you know, it actually, you know, I do find it kind of like it's not even almost offensive. It is offensive. And my favorite example is Boulder's favorite tool. Actually, I have two favorite tools, and I'm gonna throw both of them under the bus here. One, they have some of the strongest parking minimums anywhere in the United States. Very strict, very inflexible parking minimums in a city that like wants to consider itself one of the most environmentally friendly cities in America, is so wedded to parking, which is just deeply offensive to me. And two, they've really effectively used a very strict inclusionary requirement. This idea that you can't build market rate housing without also building subsidized housing, as a really effective tool, again, to prevent new housing from being built. And the sort of hypocrisy of, you know, using progressive language, while pursuing sort of openly, in my mind, regressive policies, whether that's, you know, keeping new housing from being built, keeping people out of your city, or making sure that you have enough room to park your car, is, yeah, I can't deal with it. But.
Oh, it's so maddening. I mean, there's a lot of great YIMBY advocates working in Boulder, and God bless them.
I couldn't do it. I would have a meltdown.
You move to greener pastures. Can we do a quick lightning round on Sacramento?
Yeah, totally.
Best place to get lunch in Sacramento?
Ooh, a place called Pizza Supreme Being. I am convinced that it is potentially the best pizza on the West Coast, if not the entire United States. It's just a New York Times story about it.
Wow, bold claim. Okay, Pizza Supreme Being. Favorite street to walk down in Sacramento?
I'm going to cop out. The best thing is there are so many good streets. It's the best. Favorite street is the one I haven't walked down in a while.
Do you have a favorite park?
Favorite park? I love Capitol Park, which is the like Arboretum Park around the state capitol. But also, you know, there's a park called Southside Park that's like very, just really great vibes.
No, the Arboretum is so fantastic. The mixture of palms and pine trees, it feels so authentically like capturing the spirit of California, which is just such a huge and diverse state.
Yeah. A fun thing, you can't see it right now because it's behind the fences. They're rebuilding part of the Capitol building. But someday, you know, years from now, when you can go to it again, you gotta go. There is a redwood tree just to the north side of the Capitol building that is grown from a seed that was sent, I think, Apollo 14. It was sent to the moon. Redwood seed that went to the moon, came back, and they planted it in California Capitol Park. and now it's, you know, a 60-foot tall redwood tree. It's so cool.
That's like mid-century California optimism, like more than I can
exactly.
handle. Like, we're going to take a redwood seed to the moon and bring it back.
Exactly. We're going to get that same attitude back. Yeah.
Best place to get a drink in Sacramento?
Oh, man. I love a cocktail bar called The Snug, and it just, its name is what it is.
That's perfect. Do you have a favorite drink there?
They do. Usually they have a sort of rotating old fashioned, you know, every month it's something new, slightly different, which is, it's almost always exceptional.
Perfect. Ben, well, next time I'm in Sacramento, we'll get one of the rotating old fashions, and we'll talk about all the amazing things that have probably been accomplished between then and now. I think I speak for a lot of YIMBYs when we say thanks so much for the work that you and so many other people are doing in Sacramento. I think it's just expanding the realm of possibilities for so many other cities. So where can folks find you if they want to get connected with you, or maybe they want to learn more about what you all have been up to?
Yeah, they can definitely find me on Twitter. I'm pretty sure I'm the only Ben Raderstorff in the entire world. Hopefully I'm not too hard to find. You can find House Sack at housesack.org. The other group, which we're happy to make introductions, for those of you out there who do work in city government or work in partnership with city government, if you are not calling up the community development department in Sacramento to ask their advice to get their details, to find ways to copy what they're doing, you're not doing your job very well. So we're happy to make introductions, but you can absolutely find them on the City of Sacramento website. We've got some incredible planners and civil servants and local electeds, and they're the ones who deserve the credit, right? Us advocates, we're the ones who get to come and talk about it, right? But they're the ones who put in the hard work to really make this happen. Go find them, go listen to what they have to say.
Love it. Well, Ben, thanks for coming on Abundance.
Thank you, Nolan. Great to talk to you.